Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, how's your knowledge of the moons of Jupiter? Ever heard of Europa? Turns out it could hold the answer to whether there's life, not ancient or frozen, but current life outside of Earth. Our guest tells us the story of how we plan to get there ahead. First, President Joe Biden signed more than 30 executive actions during his first week in office, and several of those focus on immigration. They include revoking President Trump's controversial travel ban on some majority Muslim countries in the Middle East and Africa, also a call to suspend construction of a border wall and preserving the DACA program. He's also asking Congress to take up an immigration reform bill that creates an 8-year pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants and expands existing visa programs. We're taking a closer look at some of Biden's actions on immigration and the effect they could have. Join us now. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Are you happy to see President Biden reversing some of his predecessor's policies, like a travel ban or constructing the border wall? Are you concerned about border security or what happens next? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay, whose research focuses on refugees and human rights. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Keeley.
President Biden has outlined a lot of his immigration agenda even before taking office. Now that he is president and is signing executive actions and proposing legislation, what's your sense of how what he's done so far breaks down between, like, agenda setting and things that will really affect people?
Yeah, that's a great question to get started. I think one thing to keep in mind with this very assertive push towards immigration reform is making it clear that he's trying to follow through on a lot of the promises he made to the Democratic base, to those grassroots organizers that were really helping him win the election, that he will move forward, that he won't make the mistake, perhaps, that his predecessor, Obama, had made in waiting until the midterms, but going ahead and being upfront with proposing an immigration legislative agenda right away, and then doing what he can through executive actions to reverse some of the things that Trump had done, also largely through executive actions. So I think we can see a combination of some real changes, because the executive actions can indeed be undone pretty quickly, but then some that will be a little trickier and thornier, where we talk about actual legislation.
This is a risk, a political risk that he runs, right, too, though, in presenting so much up front, because all of that opens him up to criticism from the right.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And we have seen some sources start to rein in expectations, especially on the legislative agenda, saying we recognize this is going to take time, or making comments like we don't expect the, quote, Biden bill to be forced all at once. Maybe this can be broken into chunks that can move through Congress in different ways. I think the backlash may come from the base, liberals and progressives, and again, those immigration advocacy groups that were so crucial to holding him accountable to his promises during the campaign, that they do want to see the kind of initial proposals he's making go through in a package, you know, pretty quickly. The big issue, of course, is that there are razor-thin margins for the Democratic majorities, and the Senate, for example, is split 50-50. So as long as we have the filibuster in place, it's unlikely that anything could move through without a true bipartisan cooperation.
Let's get into some of those more specific pieces of President Biden's plan when it comes to immigration. We're talking with Elise Cohen from UW Green Bay. She researches refugees and human rights. And you're part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know? What questions do you have about what's happening now? What do you think? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, just like Ed in Baraboo. Welcome to the conversation, Ed.
Hey, yeah. So I was just wondering, or I was just saying when I called in, I'm really happy that Joe Biden was able to push for the executive action with extending DACA. I know a lot of people in my inner circle and a lot of families are affected by those kinds of things. And these are really great working people. They come here to seek a better life, a better education. And also, it's really important to make sure that we're supporting everybody. And so I think this is a great thing that Joe Biden is doing.
Ed, thanks so much for the call. And Elise, he talks about DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Courts have upheld that program. What does this executive order from President Biden do?
Yeah, that's a really great point. And this is where we start to see some issues with how much can be long-term and permanent. So what the executive action does, it's actually a memorandum issued to the Attorney General and the DHS Secretary, just sort of instructing that DACA reflects the judgment of the administration that children brought to the U.S. who have obeyed laws, stayed in school, or enlisted in the military, and of course passed background checks, that they should be able to request temporary relief from removal. They should be able to apply for temporary work permits and not be a priority for removal, meaning deportation. But the memorandum is just kind of laying out that this is an instruction, right, that this is what we want to happen. The memorandum does not have the power to actually grant a permanent legal protected status to the Dreamers, to those that were brought here as youth. And so that's why we would really need to see legislation that makes its way through Congress in order for them to have more permanent protections or even a pathway to citizenship.
And that is something, then, that President Biden wants Congress to take up. He's proposing an immigration bill, and one of the big items here is that it includes a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. What does that pathway look like?
Yeah, that's a really important piece, and I agree that this is probably one of the most central core foundations of what the Biden administration wants to move forward as quickly as possible. So we're looking at a pathway to citizenship that would be a roughly 3 to 8 years, a 5-year path for permanent residence, then a 3-year naturalization wait to be naturalized as citizens. Now, this is limited to people with longstanding ties to the U.S. and that have been previously vetted. So this isn't, you know, every single undocumented immigrant or person in the United States. We also see this language in the fact sheet that the administration issued along with the bill proposal saying that we recognize America is a, quote, nation of immigrants. And so really trying to say this is reflecting who we are, what our values are, I think is a kind of incentive or encouragement to also Republicans that we should change alien to non-citizen. And so that goes hand in hand with the proposal of a pathway to citizenship. You know, think of these as people, not as aliens.
Yeah. If we don't have Congress, well, I mean, we don't have that legislation right now, and Congress may or may not move on that. So Jeff from Superior had a question about Biden's executive order on deportation, specifically about a Texas court ruling against that executive order on that 100-day moratorium on deportations for some undocumented immigrants. So where do we stand on this? Who gets to decide if this is something the administration can move forward?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question from the caller or the writer you mentioned. They are very on top of today's news. So just this morning, we had a federal judge block one of Biden's initial attempts to set out his immigration agenda. That was the 100-day moratorium on deportations. And unless it was somebody that's, you know, a national security or terrorist threat. And we saw the federal judge is responding to a lawsuit filed by Texas and said, well, we're going to put a pause on that moratorium at least for 14 days to really consider this lawsuit. It is unclear at this point how that will be implemented because it's not clear that ICE can be forced to deport people or forced not to deport people. But it's a very crucial window into the legal challenges that are likely to unfold, where we will probably see a lot of other lawsuits brought by Republican-led states trying to challenge some of the executive actions that Biden is able to use his power for.
We are talking with Elise Cohen right now, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW Green Bay. We're discussing the executive actions on immigration that President Biden has taken during his first week and what he's calling on Congress to do. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about President Biden's reversal of some of the Trump policies, like a travel ban from some countries in Africa and the Middle East, or constructing a border wall? What do you want to see happen with the DACA program. I mean, is there time for Congress to vote on an immigration reform bill? Should it be at the top of the list? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. This conversation continues ahead on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Right now, we're talking with Elise Cohen, a professor of political science at UW Green Bay. And we're looking at President Biden's actions on immigration during his first week in office and the immigration bill that he's proposing and wants Congress to pass. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And we've got Tyrone in Milwaukee on the line. Hey, Tyrone.
Good afternoon, ladies. Thanks for taking my call. A wonderful snowy afternoon for everybody here in Milwaukee. Yes, it is, but it's January. Very quickly, a couple different things there. You know, I don't know what all's in the bill, but I'm glad to see it go forward, you know, especially if it means, you know, we can't have people locked up in cages. You know, that's got to come to a complete stop right there. You know, I mean, people leaving their countries, you know, looking for asylum, you know, we have to reach out to the people. They're fleeing for their lives, you know, because they think they're going to be killed, as I was hearing different programs throughout the week and the day. So we need to stabilize the region. We need to bring life back to the region so they can feel safe where they are. We don't want to create a vacuum to where we just have, you know, just vast dry lands, you know. So we need to make their home places, you know, livable again to where they don't feel, that they got a fear for, you know, life or death, and to where they've got to run to stay alive, you know. So we got to stabilize the region. But most certainly we need a human side to where, you know, we can bring them to safety, but stabilize the region so they won't have to fear and run for their lives as well then.
Tyrone, thanks so much for giving us your take on what the United States' role on immigration is in the world. That makes me think of one of the most controversial parts of President Trump's early term, that so-called Muslim ban restricted travel from 8 Muslim-majority countries, and then last year added more nations to the list. President Biden is revoking that. Elise, can you remind us of the impact that's had, particularly for refugees?
Yes, I think the refugee and asylum pieces of this puzzle that the caller mentions with humanitarian protection are really crucial. One of the things where we can see Biden use that executive action very quickly and efficiently is, as you mentioned, just reversing the travel bans that Trump had put into place. So the one that got called the Muslim ban after it went through a few iterations, you know, focused on Libya, Syria, Iran, Yemen, Somalia. It also included North Korea and Venezuela with certain groups. But really what we see with the major concentration of people in need of help that are displaced, they are coming from places like Yemen and Syria, and there are millions of refugees that have been unable to access protection because of the U.S. retreat from refugee resettlement under the Trump administration. Trump was able to lower the ceiling down each year of his administration to historic lows that we haven't seen since the refugee program went into place since 1980. So we were looking at, you know, something like 20,000 refugees as a cap, whereas historically it was, you know, maybe 80 to 100,000 admissions per year. That's a place that Biden has also said he hopes to quickly make changes after this next fiscal year. He pledged to raise that back up, the admissions cap of refugees, people fleeing persecution, torture, harm, to raise it back up to 125,000 for the next year. For asylum, that is more complicated. Trump and his administration and the attorney general did so many procedural changes to narrow the eligibility, and that's for people that are arriving at our border or trying to claim asylum along our ports of entry, that will take some time. That will not be as quick as just reversing a travel ban or raising a refugee cap. I think one thing that the listeners could really look for is what will happen with the MPP, the Migration Protection Protocols, which gets called Remain in Mexico, because Biden announced that they would stop enrolling people in it right away. But we still have thousands of asylum seekers sort of stranded in Mexico along the southern border.
Let's bring Ricardo and Madison into the conversation. Hi, Ricardo.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm just bringing up the concept of the DACA program. I am a DACA recipient myself, but I like the immigration reform because that covers people who were not able to apply for it. You know, for instance, my brother, just because of the age gap. It's really very, very bad that he couldn't apply for it. And still, he should have been able to apply for it. And I feel like the immigration reform will benefit a broad, it will benefit more people. And I feel like the country, because you are paying the Homeland Security, which is right now in charge of the threat of the COVID-19 and not the threat of terrorists. And I feel like those, and I think that kind of will lead to like a follow-up question. Would those payments will benefit the Homeland Security, which is in charge of, you know, threats that hurts the country, which is the Homeland Security. How would those payments, you know, the DACA program costs $495 to renew. And I wonder if that money could also stimulate some of the crisis that we're going through.
Ricardo, thanks for that question and for sharing your story. And Elise, what else can you tell us about DACA and what Ricardo's brought up?
Yeah, that's a really crucial piece of the story, too, because DACA recipients have been subject even to threats of deportation prior to this administration coming in and issuing this memorandum that they are going to change things, that they do believe in the principles of DACA. So I think that it will be a relief for some of them to know that they will not be targeted for deportation, that they will be able to apply for renewal. There are still the issues of the renewal fees. And again, that problem for DACA recipients that they do not have permanent status. It's just a temporary kind of relief and protection. For Homeland Security, I think those that study undocumented immigrants and feeling safe or feeling protected from deportation would probably highlight on Ricardo's point that we find studies showing a higher level of trust in law enforcement in those immigrant communities that have some people without authorized status, that they are more likely to go to the police. They are more likely to raise the alert or warning on possible threats and dangers when they feel like they are safe from themselves being deported when they come forward as witnesses. So from a criminal justice and Homeland Security perspective, I think there is something there where it could improve safety to have these communities feel like they can come forward and be open with law enforcement.
Elise, so much to talk about. We've scratched the surface. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great to speak with you.
Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. The vaccine rollout has been challenging everywhere, but parts of rural Wisconsin are facing additional hurdles in getting the shots into people's arms. Rural health systems have limited resources, pharmacies are scarce, and in sparsely populated areas, the nearest healthcare provider may be an hour away. Danielle Kading reports.
Nurse practitioner Rebecca Fleming didn't feel the shot when she received the COVID-19 vaccine recently at the North Lakes Community Clinic in downtown Ashland.
There you are, ma'am. You got
easy.
To hang with us for 15 minutes.
Sounds good. Thank you. Yeah, it was easy.
Fleming was one of around 200 healthcare workers who got the Moderna vaccine at North Lakes 14 clinics in rural northern Wisconsin. CEO Reba Rice says they've been lucky to get all the doses they requested so far. But she acknowledged the rollout has been anything but smooth for health officials and providers in Wisconsin.
The lack of coordination has really been a problem. And we did have a summer to think about it. But I just think this gobsmacked everybody.
The population in rural parts of the state tends to be older, which means people could be more at risk of serious complications from the coronavirus. And rural Wisconsin was already facing a shortage of healthcare resources before the pandemic. While nearly one-fifth of the state's population resides in rural communities, less than 10% of physicians practice in rural areas. Rural health departments are also stretched thin.
Our county health department, there is right now two nurses, so we really did not have the capacity to be able to offer the vaccine.
Health Officer Terry Harmala with Menominee and Shawnee counties says her department is partnering with larger healthcare systems like ThetaCare so people can get the shots. Across the state, many residents have been confused about how and where the shots will be administered. With limited staff and resources, John Ike thinks that should have been worked out sooner to fill in any gaps. He's director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health.
So we needed to figure out, well, where can these people go in every county in the state? and who would be doing the vaccinating?
Bayfield County Health Director Sarah Wortman says the vaccine is a light at the end of the tunnel for the pandemic. But in the meantime, she's worried about burnout among her 13 staff.
While we have a lot of hope and inspiration right now, it kind of was like this when COVID first happened. My staff were really resilient and gung-ho, lots of energy. But when we realized it wasn't going to be over in 2 months, it was really hard to keep going.
She adds that transportation is a real problem in rural areas, where some residents live an hour away from the nearest healthcare provider. In some parts of the state, pharmacy chains CVS and Walgreens are working to vaccinate nursing home residents under a federal partnership. But those outlets aren't everywhere.
How many CVSs do we have in Bayfield County? None. Absolutely none.
It's one of 15 counties in Wisconsin that doesn't have a chain pharmacy. Wortman is planning to vaccinate residents at a dozen sites across the county. A study by the University of Iowa's Rural Policy Research Institute found 5 counties in Wisconsin have just one pharmacy. Florence County is one of 110 rural counties nationwide that has none. The state is providing $86 million to help bring resources to local and tribal health departments. And Wisconsin's Deputy Health Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke says they're also sending mobile vaccination teams to help vaccinate in rural areas.
And for those where adding additional staff is not feasible, we'll have this additional state asset to supplement their resources.
Despite those resources, plenty of rural health officials feel the state should have been better prepared to address issues with rolling out the vaccine to all parts of the state. But Reba Rice with Northlake says now is not the time for blame.
Right now is the time to just roll up your sleeves and get people healthy.
And in rural communities, many residents are eager to roll up their sleeves for their dose of protection. Danielle Kadang, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find more of our COVID-19 coverage by visiting WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we follow the money, the politics, the people that failed and failed and failed before succeeding in setting up a mission to Jupiter's moon Europa. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, hear from the Deputy Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Wisconsin's coronavirus vaccine rollout is among the slowest in the nation. Learn about the process, how eligible adults can access doses, and who's next in line. The morning show airs from 6 until 9 weekdays here on the Ideas Network. Now, what motivates people to work on a project that may not, likely will not, be completed during their lifetime? How about the possibility of discovering life on another planet? We've got questions and we're getting some answers through real-life stories of people who work to develop a future NASA mission. It's focused on one of the moons orbiting Jupiter and what we hope to find there. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. How closely have you followed this effort to reach Jupiter's moon Europa? Are you much of a stargazer? What questions do you have about the U.S. space program, how it's run so far, or how it might look in the future? Call 800-642-1234 or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is David W. Brown. He's a writer based in New Orleans. He regularly contributes to a number of outlets, including The New York Times, The Atlantic, and Scientific American. His new book out today is called The Mission. And it has a pretty lengthy subtitle that fills up the whole cover, but we'll just say it contains a story of the many pushes for NASA to explore the Jupiter moon Europa, not to mention a lot of inside looks at how major milestones in the U.S. space program have come to be or barely happened at all. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we talk too much about Europa, we should ask, what is it and where is it?
Europa orbits the planet Jupiter. It is an ocean moon. It's surrounded by an ice shell, but inside it has a liquid saltwater ocean. It's about the size of our own moon, but it has 3 times more water than than the planet Earth.
How do we know all of that about it?
Well, the ocean was hypothesized for a very long time, and it was proven, I believe, in 2000 by the Galileo spacecraft. Physicists were able to run an experiment that essentially looked for a magnetic field that was induced by Jupiter. What this means is, or in real world terms, when you walk through the metal detector at an airport, they essentially turned a spacecraft into a metal detector. And that meant either the interior of Europa is made of metal, which it's not, or there is a liquid saltwater ocean down there.
Can you put this into context about things we know about other bodies in space? Are a lot of things covered in ice? The water content certainly seems like it is unique.
There are other ocean worlds in the solar system, and that's sort of an emerging part of planetary science now. Some of the moons include Enceladus and Titan, both of which orbit Saturn.
Why then, if we know these exist, is Europa so important for determining that question that we keep asking, whether life in some form exists elsewhere in our solar system beyond Earth?
Right. So what makes Europa unique, certainly what's been studied and researched very deeply, is the ingredients necessary for life. And that's something that Europa really brings to the table. 3 times more water than Earth, that's great. But there are also hydrothermal vents on the bottom of the ocean that essentially blast hot water into that ocean. You've also, and so that's introducing energy into the equation. On the ocean floor, you have water touching rock, which is how you get interesting chemistry happening. So when you've got water, you've got chemistry, you've got energy, you also have, by way of the ice shell of Europa, the way it convects, it's plate tectonics, you're also introducing oxygen into that ocean. So if there's anywhere in the solar system that has life, it's certainly there. It might be single-celled organisms, but it might be complex life, maybe fish, maybe sea monsters.
Maybe complex life.
Absolutely.
Let's talk first about what the plan is, and then we can step back and figure out how we got here. Several past missions to Europa fell through, but now one is actually scheduled in just a couple of years.
Right. That mission is called Europa Clipper. It's a mission to Europa has been decades in the making. This one is a Jupiter orbiter, and it circles Jupiter dozens or hundreds of times, depending on how long the mission goes. And it scans Europa in slices. Each time it circles Jupiter and encounters Europa and gets one different slice every time until finally you get sort of a 360-degree globe. What makes exploring Europa particularly challenging is that it orbits Jupiter in what's called the Jovian radiation belt, which has conditions not unlike the aftermath of a thermonuclear bomb. It's probably the least hospitable place in the solar system for a spacecraft and certainly the computer inside of it. And that's been the challenge over all these years, how to survive in that radiation in order to learn about the habitability of this moon and what lies beneath that ice.
We are talking with David Brown, who wrote the book, The Mission. It's about NASA's exploration of Jupiter's moon, Europa, and what we could find there. What questions do you have? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234, taking your questions or your thoughts about this mission. Maybe you've done some research into the U.S. space program. What question do you have, or what do you want to share with us? 800-642-1234. This book that you've written, David, it shows that you have really incredible access to people at various levels of NASA, as well as other space programs. How did you get so many people to tell you their stories?
Well, I knew for a story like this, when I started writing the book, I had no idea it would be quite this difficult. In the end, it ended up taking 7 years to write, or just under 7 years. I interviewed over 100 people. And the access was built over time. I did my homework. I built trust with members of the Europa team. I made friendships. And ultimately, I just made a whole lot of phone calls and did a whole lot of traveling in order to show people that I was taking their life's work seriously. One thing that I would always tell them, and that's very true, is that this is my book, but it's your story, and I want to represent it accurately, and I want to do justice to your life's work.
Yeah. So many origin stories. I mean, significant moments from earlier in their lives show up in your book, and you see how that sets these people in motion to become space scientists. Could you retell one of your favorite stories for us about how that happened?
Oh, there are so many. I would say I was one of the first stories that I learned was that of Louise Proctor, who works at the Applied Physics Laboratory now. She initially didn't go to college. She just went on, lived her life, sold office supplies, and she was pretty good at it. Then she started selling typewriters. She wasn't so good at that, but eventually she decided, you know, maybe I want a little more out of my life. Maybe this isn't what I was meant to do. So she went back to college as an adult, and she turned out she was pretty good at it. She checked the box marked science because that's what her father studied as a teacher. In the end, she became one of the world's foremost subject matter experts, one of the greatest planetary scientists walking the planet today. I think that this book it's not really a book about space. It's not really a book about science. It's a book about people at crossroads in their lives and how they handle it. What direction do they go, left or right? And it just so happens all of the people in this book happen to make the right choice and in the end would come together to build this incredible thing that couldn't happen without any single one of them.
Huh. And then because you talk to so many people, I wonder, what impression did you get from them? What makes them tick to be able to work on a project that is so far beyond maybe what they will even see?
Well, thankfully, for a great many of them, I think that they will see it. Europa Clipper is likely to launch in 2025 now, and it'll have a 6 or 7 year journey to Jupiter and eventually settle into orbit and begin studying Europa. But one of my challenges or goals in this book or in writing this book, I wanted to make sure that I sort of brought to the reader a certain empathy for the characters in it and really put the reader in that person's head, his or her. And in the end, that required so many interviews and so much traveling. It was so exhausting. But what happened in the end, when I was actually writing the book, pulling from all of these interviews that were done over so many years, I would have 15 or 20 interviews with 4 or 5 different people. Some interviews were done in 2014. Some interviews were done in 2019. Some were done in 2017. And for each passage that I was writing, and sometimes each sentence, I'm drawing from 4 or 5 or 10 different interviews to make, to sort of add little pieces to build that mosaic, that tell that story, reveal that picture of the Europa story. I hope that I was successful in that. It seems to be well received, and I'd like to say that I succeeded in doing justice to the hard work that these men and women do.
Yeah, you saw where everything converged. We're talking with writer David Brown about his new book called The Mission. It's largely based on the people who've worked for decades in some cases to get a NASA mission launched to search for life on Europa. That's one of the moons of Jupiter. And we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Have we piqued your interest in Europa? What questions do you have about what we could find there? 800-642-1234 or send us an email at ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We are picking up our talk with author David Brown about his new book on space exploration and Jupiter's moon Europa. It's out today. It's called The Mission. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Carol in Glendale has a question for us. Hey, Carol.
Hi, hello. Yes, David, I have 3 questions. I have, the cost, the time and the cost of such an expedition to Europa. You know, how much does that run approximately? And And who pays for all of it? And then the second question is, what benefits do we derive from this exploration? You know, how are we benefiting our planet, our people? And at this time, the money's spent on this. Wow, it seems this is a time we should be spending on other things. But yeah. Then there's a question for you, David. As you know, you're writing, it sounds like you're putting in, you know, a vast amount of time and effort into this book. And I wonder what keeps you going on this.
Carol, thank you so much. That's a fair question. I do think let's take that last one first, David. Like, how do you just keep going? I see some parallels here with the scientists who've dedicated their life to something.
That certainly occurred to me 5 years into the project. That maybe I was learning the hard way exactly how difficult their job was. Of course, they did. It took them two or three times longer than it took me to write the book. But I think what drove me to keep going was really a dedication to good storytelling. I wanted to make I didn't know if this would be the last big book that I would ever write in my career. And so I wanted to make sure if I was going to have the shot, I was going to swing for the fences. And that really did keep me going. I never hated the book. I never hated the subject. I never hated the people. And when you, I think any writer can attest, you hate your project after a certain amount of time. And that never happened to me. So I have to consider that a good sign.
Yeah, to resent it a little bit. And I want to get to Carol's other questions, but I do want to focus just a little bit more on your writing, because there's this like quiet cleverness to pieces of it. I mean, I laughed out loud just on page 17, where you're talking about the universe beginning and you're like, good old atomic number one. And then you talk about it cooling into a quark soup. I mean, the way you're writing about this is not some like dry textbook version of this story.
I knew when I was writing this book that probably the best way to do it would be through creative nonfiction, which is bringing in elements of poetry and fiction, it's sort of this narrative devices in order to tell a nonfiction story. It's a genre that I'm familiar with. It's something that I write quite often, and the story just lends itself to that. Science is not, it's particularly multidisciplinary science, like the field of planetary science, is not inherently accessible to most people. And most people probably bring an impoverished understanding of how the solar system works and how the universe works. And that's just, you know, that's just a result of people have other interests, and there's nothing wrong with that. So yeah. I knew I had to tell it in a way that would be captivating to readers, and also tell it in a way that really spoke to the art and somehow pushed forward the science writing genre. And I think I succeeded with that. I certainly tried. It is really hard to write a book that feels like it was really easy to write. Those are the hardest kinds of books to
write.
Fair point. So I had to really slave over some of those sentences, but I absolutely, I can honestly say that I did the best I could do. And there's not a lot of things in life when you can say, I could not have done any better than I did. And I really gave it my all. I hope it works. And I'm glad you laughed.
Yeah, I did. David Brown wrote the book, The Mission. It's about NASA's exploration of Jupiter's moon Europa and what we could find there. And we're talking about it now. And Carol had a similar question to a caller, Mark, who couldn't stay with us. They both, you know, said, we're spending a lot on space exploration and there are issues on Earth that we need to fix. Mark mentioned infrastructure, you know, Carol mentioned it at the end. So what does this mission cost and how do we justify it when it's for exploration?
That's a really good question. And I think a lot of people have a misconception about what NASA's budget is. I think if you ask most people, they might say 25% of the federal budget, 30% of the federal budget. In fact, NASA gets one half of 1% of the federal budget. It's a rounding error in the Defense Department budget. Something like a mission to Europa, the numbers kind of go back and forth, but we can safely say $3 billion, which is fighter jet money. It's practically nothing in terms of government spending. And accordingly, I mean, it's a lot of money, but it's not real government money, if that makes sense. As a result, what we're getting back is so much more than what's being invested. It's all return. And the questions that are going to be answered by Europa Clipper and any follow-on missions in a Europa exploration sequence get to the heart of religion, philosophy, and science itself. I mean, are we alone in the solar system? Or in the universe? We're going to know. What does it take to create life? What does it take to sustain life? Where does it come from? What does it look like? Everything we know about life on Earth comes from, obviously, a common origin. What would life look like that came from a different origin? We'll be able to answer those questions. Space exploration in general is the only human endeavor that I can think of where people say, well, why should we spend money up there when we have so many problems down here? But what that means is we have to solve literally every problem in the world before we do this. I mean, we would never do anything in life if we said, we'll solve every single other problem, then we'll do that. It's kind of an absurd thing when you really think it through. The very fact that we're having this conversation right now over the miracle of the internet and technology, all of that comes directly. Those are benefits yielded from the American space program and the global space program.
Let's bring in one more caller. Stuart from Milwaukee wants to talk with us. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, thank you for having me. Yeah, my question is really, as we're learning about Europa and the search for life there, where are the scientists thinking along the lines of, is it panspermia, so microbes, you know, hitching a ride on a meteor, or is it, generated from the right mix of amino acids and the heat from the thermal vents, or is there any new thinking along those lines?
Yeah, Stuart, thanks for the question. And it's clear you know a lot about this stuff. David, talk more about that life we're looking for on Europa.
That's a very good question. And that's one of the things that ultimately a continued exploration of Europa would be able to answer. I don't think that's something that anybody can actually answer right now. I will say that, for example, if we found life on Mars, there's a good chance it at some point came from Earth after some major collision event, knocking this form into space. And eventually, as the planets orbit, the terrestrial planets are certainly sharing their rocks and their life, if such a thing exists. That probably wouldn't be the case with Europa. If it's had 4 billion years beneath that ice shell to create life, it's had all the ingredients necessary to make life. And if anywhere in the solar system can do it, it's there. And I think it's important that we, just as a species, that we figure out, how did it happen? Did it happen? And if so, how?
And I just want to squeeze in one more question. Alec from Beaver Dam was wondering, how will we probe, how will we find that intelligent life? How will we know?
Well, so Europa Clipper is a habitability mission. And what it's going to do is determine where, in what way is Europa habitable, and where on Europa would be the most habitable places. A follow-on mission, a lander, would actually touch down on the surface of Europa, sort of saw 10 centimeters beneath that ice. And once it digs that little hole, it essentially works like a powerful microscope, and it can look for evidence of things that once wiggled.
Excellent. David, this is fascinating. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
David Brown is a writer based in New Orleans, and we talked with him about his new book out today called The Mission. It looks at the decades-long push for NASA to explore Jupiter's moon Europa in search of other life in the solar system. Again, this was David W. Brown, who is a writer who is writing about space. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Thanks for being here. Gymnast Nia Dennis is grabbing headlines with her latest floor routine. The UCLA athlete's latest performance features a medley of hip-hop hits. She says the routine is about her personal history and who she is as a woman and about culture. The video of her performance is circulating with the hashtag Black Excellence. Dennis also wanted to have a dance party with this routine, and it's pretty undeniable that she achieved that. She executes a perfect double back tuck in addition to all of those usual tumbles and flips and splits. And she incorporated the crip walk, heel toe, and added stepping into her routine as a shout out to Black fraternities. On Saturday, Dennis's floor routine got a score of 9.95 out of 10. That pushed her team to victory. It's really incredible to watch. We tweeted a link to the video. You can find it by following us at Central Time WPR. And if this sounds familiar, it's because Nia Dennis went viral with another routine last year. That one was inspired by Beyonce. This time, Beyonce's music made an appearance, plus Tupac, Missy Elliott, Soulja Boy, Eazy-E, Dr. Dre, Megan Thee Stallion, and Kendrick Lamar. This is Central Time.